If we could get started again, thank you all for being here and participating. My name is Julie Underwood. I'm the Dean of the School of Education here at UW-Madison. You might wonder what my interest is in need-based financial aid. And I'll tell you first, one of my interests in need-based financial aid certainly is that the School of Education is home to a number of the campus-wide diversity programs at UW-Madison. We've got some spectacular programs, the People Program, the Posse Program, TRIO, which is now CO, and the Office of Multicultural Arts Initiatives. All of them are wonderful programs and various ways that we try to provide students an opportunity on our campus. And, of course, they are hubs for need, for need-based financial aid. It always breaks my heart when I know that we have so many more gifted students that we could be bringing to campus, and yet we may not have the funds to either provide incentives or support for them, the distinction that Sarah made earlier. But fundamentally, my interest is in getting great students to our campus, regardless of their socioeconomic status. You know, realtors say that in their field it's location, location, location. As an educator, I think in my field it's people, people, people. And getting great people to our campuses, regardless of socioeconomic status, is really the heart and the soul of the enterprise. So I guess my goal is to improve educational opportunities for all students, and I'm certain that that's a goal that everyone in this room shares. Need-based financial aid certainly is a good path to that goal. And our last panel was, and the conversation after our panel, was a great demonstration of the collaboration that's currently existing and the collaboration that is needed further to get us along that path to that goal. The next set of topics actually continues this exploration, looking at improving access to higher education and the impact of higher education on our state. So let me introduce our next two speakers. First speaking will be Dennis Winters. Dennis is the chief economist in the Office of Economic Advisors in the Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development, where he specializes in regional and national macroeconomics, energy and labor markets, and economic impact analysis. For the past 30 years, Dennis has been a consulting economist with senior positions at Wharton Econometric Forecasting Associates, McGraw-Hill, and several years as the vice president and director of research for North Star Economics. As an advisor to industry, government agencies, and elected officials, he has testified before governmental investigative bodies on market issues and has appeared in the national and international press in such outlets as the Wall Street Journal and Investors Daily and the Christian Science Monitor. Dennis is a graduate of UW-Madison. His presentation today will focus on the important issues of workforce development in Wisconsin, including findings from a study he's working on with WISCAPE's support. His insight on this topic, I'm sure, will give us an appreciation and understanding of the important role of higher education and financial aid, and particularly how this plays a role in the life of the state. Second, we'll hear from John Hoffmeyer, who is the director of the Center on Business and Poverty at UW-Madison. His 20 years' experience in equity investing, venture capital, consulting, and investment banking. John's research and work have focused on employee stock ownership. Let me say this again, employee stock ownership plans, also known as ESOP, which adds another acronym to those of us who live in education. We have our own vocabulary of acronyms. He was founder and CEO of his own investment banking firm. He helped employees buy and manage approximately $2 billion worth of that ESOP stock before he sold that firm to American Capital. After the sale, he continued with American Capital as their senior investment officer. John has also served as vice president at Ampersand Ventures, formerly Payne Weber's Equity Group, and has worked as a consultant at Bain & Company. John earned his degree from Stanford University, and today he'll be offering his years of experience and expertise to help us understand the complexities and implications of combining tax preparation, IRS data, and the FAFSA, something that we're all very interested in, particularly those of us who are parents and have to file those FAFSAs ourselves. This is a project that he started with in using some seed money from WISCAPE, but it's actually something that he's been working on for quite a while. So the procedure we're going to use here is first we're going to hear from Dennis, and then we're going to hear from John. We're going to hold our questions until the end, and we'll combine a question and answer session at the end of the second presentation. So, Dennis.
Okay, can you hear me? Got the new microphone going here. My presentation is going to be a little bit different, but I think it ties in to what y'all doing, because what I spend my day doing in and out every day is figuring out what Wisconsin's economy is doing, and more importantly, looking more to the future and what the workforce and the economy are doing as they're intermingled, because workforce development these days is very much economic development, and it's going to be true more and more as we go forward in a global environment where talent is the most valuable raw material. So that said, I want to start out with the major policy issues facing certainly America and a lot of Western Europe in the next 20 years. We spend a lot of time looking at demographics, right? And I don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to have to widen all the bike paths, right, around the city to make them able to accommodate the bikers and these folks. We've already seen some of these people up on the square, and I think it's underestimated the impact they're going to have. But more to the point, this is a graph of Wisconsin's population, yellow line, and Wisconsin's workforce, the blue line. And you can see the population's been growing pretty steady rate, you know, from 1960 is what the history is here in this graph, on up. And we saw a little dip here, right, when the baby boomers, I'm going to be talking a lot about baby boomers, those born between 1946 and 1964, any of you? You know, looking around, it looks like you weren't all truthful there. and this was essentially when our parents passed through the childbearing age and before we got into it. So there's the dip there. And so it's going to keep growing. The workforce, on the other hand, is going to flatten out, because all the baby boomers will be exiting the workforce as rapidly as they entered it, and then some probably. This is huge. It's unprecedented. It's not going away. And it's largely unalterable. And from an economic standpoint, if you've got a flat workforce and you don't raise productivity sufficiently, you're not going to increase incomes, your whole economy is going to stagnate. Huge point. And I know a lot of people know that baby boomers are on their way out, or will be. I don't know if they know the ramifications of that. And we're going to get into that a little more as we go. So one solution, just keep the old folks working, right? Tie them to the desk and take them away when they don't show for lunch. And we know some of that's going on. Okay, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, has looked at this, and they've changed their labor force participation rates. Now, this is a graph of labor force participation rates, and it says of the workforce, how many by age cohort are in the workforce. So you can see 16 to 19, it's the younger kids, they ramp up into their working years, and then they drop off very rapidly as they age. And this decline starts at about 55, roughly. And it drops up from the high 80s, you know, in some of these points, down in the 70s, and in a rapid decline till we get into single digits within, you know, 10, 20 years. But what the BLS has recognized is that the older folks are going to stay in the workforce a little longer, so they've pushed these curves out a little bit by decade. Okay? So we're going to have more older workers as time goes on. Now, when I refer to older workers, we refer to those 55 years and older. Interesting, though, is that the younger workers are going to be in the workforce at a lower rate, okay, which is important as we go forward. So that's what it looks like. Now, the women's curve is a little lower than this, and that's changed over time. That's a topic for another day. But so the BLS numbers, if we take the new BLS numbers from what they had in their base case, right, we start the white lines here. We add some workers as we go forward, and that's good for the workforce, the flattening workforce. We had about 20,000 in 2010. We're up here about 40,000 in 2020, and then we're actually less under the new numbers because the baby boomers have gone out and the young kids aren't working at the same rates. So we actually dropped by 2030. 2030, I think I'm 85, something like that, and I'm not going to be working anymore. But what we did at DWD and in OEA, Office of Economic Advisors, we built a little model that said, all right, let's see what happens if we make some other assumptions. This red bar, we added 3 percentage points on top of the new BLS numbers for the older workers. So if they were at 70%, right, we added, it made it 73%. So we pushed those curves out a little bit more. And this is the results we've got with 3 percentage point increase. So in 2010, we've got 120,000 new workers, or continued workers. I think this was about 73 or 77, and this is in the 56,000, I think the number is, right? So that's a pretty good addition, and that's a good thing, right? So we think, well, we've got some reasonable, this is a reasonable estimate. These are the ramifications. But if you put it in the scheme of things, it doesn't amount really to a hill of beans, right? It doesn't change that curve much at all. Now, a lot of this is just based on demographics, some of the best data we have, right? Every hour, y'all get an hour older, nothing's going to change that, right? So this is like about the best data we have going forward, and it's powerful. So even with that kind of programs and such, there isn't much of a change there. Well, what's the effects of that, then, this flattening workforce? We've alluded to it a little bit. I'm kicking into a part that Noel and Wiscape helped us fund. Going through, and I see Victoria just moved into the back office. She's a staffer of mine part-time now because she's working on her PhD in economics here, so I only get so many hours out of her these days. But she's done a lot of the work on this new stuff. And this is just kind of a list of what we looked at for data. We broke we built some tools here. We broke it down by age cohort so we can follow the baby boomers through. We broke it down by education attainment level as a proxy for education and training and as a proxy for productivity, higher skills. And then we broke it down. We had to break it down by income streams because we know that income streams change as you get older. Okay? So those are the basic things we broke down, and we're using that as a tool. Now, the income streams, I'll start with the last to bring it first. This is the income streams in 2000. Okay? And you can see 82% of it was earned income. So what you get in your paycheck, okay? 7.6% is all that investment return you're getting, right, from your portfolios these days. And then 10.3 is the transfer payments, right, mainly Medicare, Social Security. But by the time we get to 2035, right, a large chunk of this is shifted into the transfer payments, the Social Security, essentially. For the older folks, okay? Their earnings are down and their transfer payments are up. And what we know about transfer payments, okay, is that essentially they're flat in real terms as you go forward. So there's not any real income gains in transfer payments as we go forward. That's the assumption we're making at this point. So what happens with all of this is we put it together in what we call our version 2. We had a version 1 that was a base case, so we were just trying to figure things out. And what we did is in version 2, we essentially we brought in the income changes, right? And then left the rest of it constant. So this is just due to aging and the transfer and the change in income streams, okay? You can see this is real earnings. They've flattened out. By 2030 and 2035. This has grown at, I think, less than 0.2% at that point, right? Next to nothing, certainly well within the error. And how it slows down just because the baby boomers move out of the workforce. So this is real. So this has all kinds of tax ramifications, right? Because the income tax is tied to income in a lot of ways. And property taxes, everything else, sales taxes, because if you're not earning more, you're not going to buy more, right? And there's a whole shift that's going on there. So this is added fuel to the fire. Well, we know, and this is what happens. This, I think, is huge, because people ask me, as an economist in economic development, what's the single thing you look at if you had to take one metric, right? What do you look at to judge the health of a place? And I look at the dynamics of per capita income, how that's changing over time. And what this graph says, the blue is population growth, the red bars are the income growth, right? By 2015, which isn't very far away now that we're looking at 2010, right? Per capita income starts to go down in the state. Well, we weren't satisfied with that initial one. Like I say, we had to bring in education attainment because we know education attainment is increasing. Now, I've got some slides that we could open up a whole debate on that, but these are essentially graphs that I pulled out that Victoria had looked at, and this is a history of education attainment by age cohort, okay? And then we essentially just kind of straight-lined them out for projections. From like here out, that's our assumptions, right, of where the education attainment level by age cohort is going to go. Now, the ones that are going down, the blue line is high school, right? All they get is a high school diploma. The red line is less than high school. And the thing we had to be careful of is that we couldn't let any of these, the biggest thing we had to do is we couldn't let any of these go to zero. Right, so the less than high school and high school, we had to constrain on the bottom because it couldn't go to zero. So we kind of, you know, made them asymptotes. Is that what it is? Asymptotic on the axis. And the other thing, the constraint was they all had to sum to one or 100%. Right. So all these graphs do that. So now we incorporate these trends into our analysis, and we get the orange line. All right. So we get a little boost from what we know are the education trends going forward up to 2035. But still, once we get out here, this is growing at less than a half. I think it's growing actually in less than 0.4%. 0.4%. All right? So you gain a little, but you don't gain a lot. And a 0.4% real terms is not a sufficient growth rate to really make an economy grow sufficiently. And again, you bring it back on the tax side, you bring it back on infrastructure, you bring it back on all the resources that are available to pay for public education, for example. Okay? It's huge. And what this did then is the yellow bars, all right, so it gave us a boost in the income, and all it does is push this per capita problem out about 5 years. Now, when I say 2020, you know, 10 years ago, that was way out there. Well, it's not out there very far anymore, right? You're all going to experience this. So this is the work we've come up with, and I think this has got huge policy. Hopefully, this will have huge policy issues, right? And we're on the verge of this. We've got a little bit of time. And it's this kind of confidence. How can we remedy, right, getting more talent into the workforce? Because we have a flat workforce. One, we got to find every body we can, right, to put them to work. Otherwise, we're not going to have enough of them. And of everybody we can find, we got to get them up the scale, the education training scale, as far as we can. Another thing I talk about, one rung up, right? If you got a high school diploma, You know, get some college. If you got some college, get a degree. You get a bachelor's degree, go on and on. Everybody took one step up, you know, it would make a big difference. So this is where we're at. So in summary, so we've got a quantity issue and a quality issue in the workforce. It's unprecedented, right? So the workforce trends are unprecedented. We've never faced it before. Demographics are going to change little, so it's pretty well assured and largely unalterable. That's a mouthful. Demographics and migration patterns don't really shift abruptly either, okay? Especially the demographic side. And then finally, the ramifications, potentially devastating. Without sufficient productivity gains, the state's economy stagnates. Now, this is true not only in Wisconsin, pretty much the upper Midwest, because we're about as far as you can get, right, from the horseshoe of immigration centers. And like I say, they're not flocking in here from Canada so much. So necessitating a focus on talent. We have to do this to raise the productivity, to keep the workforce growing. And I would put higher ed in here, certainly. And another thing I've got going is the other end of the spectrum, early ed. In fact, we're looking at 0 to 5, early childhood development and the investments on that. And then the other part is it's got to do this in concert with business and industry development. Okay? Because if the talent supply doesn't match the industry demand, you're going to lose them both. Because if I'm talented and I can't find a job, I'm going somewhere else. If I'm an industry and I can't find the talent, I'm going somewhere else. Right? So you got to have that match. So that's all I've got prepared. So thanks, and John.
I want to thank Wiscape and Noel, Julie, for the introduction, and I want to thank Dennis for what he's just laid out for us. Well, this is a little bit of a macro view that you've received from Dennis. I want to go micro on you, but first I want to tell you a little bit more about my background, because in the end, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to speak in a very open way that reflects more of my past background. And then you're going to see me read slides, which is the new part of me that is involved with tax forms and is learning about FAFSA. And so to understand a little bit more about the past, I got involved with employee ownership, ESOPs, by working with farm workers. As a high school student, I got involved with the United Farm Workers. When I went to another great biological sciences university, UC Davis, as an undergraduate, the first week I was there, I got involved with other students starting essentially farm worker co-ops for 800 people who otherwise were being displaced by the mechanization of the tomato harvest. And I've spent really almost all my career working with very low-income people, mostly in manufacturing environments, helping employees buy companies that were being shut down. And now for these last 6 years, I've been helping people prepare tax forms. And so... In the end, what I want you to trust more is the sort of gut instinct that I have about having spent my life trying to help low-income people move up a little bit. It's not that I want you to distrust the slides that I'll read, because those come directly out of GAO reports, the General Accounting Office, and they're probably more trustworthy than I am. But in the end, I want you to see if you can help me blend what I'm going to be saying today. Person who has a background working on issues involving low-income families with some changes that are going to happen technologically as the tax form essentially probably takes over for the FAFSA. And so with that introduction, I'll launch into my slides. The challenge is that as tax information is moved from the FAFSA electronically, we enter a new age. And I think all of us have watched where things that we expected to happen technologically don't always happen. All you have to do is think about the computers that we use. I apologize to the gentleman who asked the question about loan forgiveness. That was my computer that crashed first and then turned back on and made noise earlier. Think of that on a national basis. That's what we're heading into as probably the FAFSA becomes usurped by the tax form. The background on FAFSA, I think most of you know this. You're looking at 10 million FAFSAs, 96 billion of financial aid delivered, and these $4 billion worth of costs can basically be partly built off the 10 million FAFSAs. So the cost to the students is assuming that our time is worth about $20 an hour and that it takes 10 hours to complete a FAFSA form. And so you have that cost of complexity today to the students and their families. And then many of you know much more about this than I do, but there's a cost to the colleges and universities also to correct the problems that occur as FAFSAs are not completed correctly and as tax forms are not completed correctly. On the tax preparation side, we're looking at 2.8 million people who get their tax forms completed for free today at volunteer income tax assistance centers, VITA sites, and also by groups like AARP that do the work for seniors. The average low-income taxpayer paid $348 at H&R Block last year. That's about a 3% tax on people just to get their taxes done if you make $9 an hour. I want to actually go back to the comments that were made earlier about loan forgiveness, because much of this $348 cost is reflected through refund anticipation loans. Everybody know what a refund anticipation loan is? The head's nodding. Essentially, people who don't have money and know they've got an average, if you're low income, of about $1,400 coming back on your refund, want that money as soon as possible. And so you see very large numbers of people show up both at VITA sites and at places like H&R Block to get their taxes done as soon as possible in February. This is not something that I intended to go into, but one of my concerns about loan forgiveness is I've seen the effect of loans on low-income people. And so if we move toward a system that actually encourages those that have the best ability to finish school and get that loan forgiveness, we're going to see another end of the curve that will be the people who are least able to finish college, and they will be the ones who will be left holding the bag and needing to repay that debt. Now, I'm not opposed to incentives. You heard me say I come out of business. I like incentives, but I want to be very aware of how the incentives, especially around loan repayment type issues, affect very low-income families. And it's not just refund anticipation loans. We've seen it in mortgages. You've seen it in credit cards. I just want people to think through what the ramifications of some of the policies are. This is where I really start reading from the slides. So this is the Department of Education promise that's come out of the GAO meetings, the announcement that Secretary Duncan has made in the recent months. So starting January 2010, what we'll see is that students applying for financial aid will be able to seamlessly retrieve relevant tax information from the IRS. This will lead to easier completion of the online FAFSA, direct from the GAO report that came out. I think this is good news. What is the next step? Well, the Obama administration promises that the administration will seek statutory authority, that means we'll have legislation, to remove data and information requirements from the FAFSA and aid calculations if the data is not available from the IRS. Continuing, this would remove 26 questions from the FAFSA. You're supposed to say hallelujah at this point. These questions are often hard to complete and have little impact on awarding the aid. So I said 10 hours to complete the FAFSA. When we do this today and someone goes from one site, one table at a VITA site, and gets their taxes done and then goes to the next table, it's 15 minutes to complete the tax form. And so those 26 questions are what confuse people. And if they don't do the same taxes and FAFSA at the same time, often you have that complexity that leads to a 10-hour FAFSA completion. what might happen with a FAFSA tax form combo. And these statistics can be a little bit different. I heard earlier a different number from what I have at the bottom, but they're, you know, directionally correct. The first number, though, 8 million students who don't currently apply for aid might be more likely to do so. Many of these students are low income. And I'm saying 2.3 million more would qualify. I heard 1.8 million, close enough. I'm going to talk a little bit about some research that I did that shows what kind of impact you can have when you do a variety of types of benefit enrollments at tax time. This was a study that was done at Staples. We had, and I need to give you a little bit of background here because I only have one slide and on this topic, and if you don't have the background, you'll wonder about some of this. So essentially, a lot of our work is done at employer sites. We believe that over time that the government's not going to have as much money as it does today. I mean, it's not hard to project that. And when you look at where the money actually is, it's at corporations. If you want to have impact on low-income people's lives, clearly education is the biggest driver. But once people get out of school, I'm looking at the employers as the place where you can have impact. And so we went to the industry where we felt the most low-income workers would be, are, and we chose the retail industry. And Staples, in particular, was the company we had access to. So the governor of Massachusetts, the CFO of Citicorp, and a Harvard Business School professor of the chairman of Staples all sent emails to the chairman, who received those emails on the same day, and all the emails said the same thing. You got to see this crazy guy, Hoffmeyer. He's got an idea for you. And so the chairman said yes. He saw me for 20 minutes. And I told them, what we want to do is to sign up your people for benefits at the same time we do their taxes for free. And so he put me in touch with the number two person in human resources at Staples. We started working together. I'll tell you the end of the story from a statistical perspective, but in some ways it's just as important for you to know that the man that the chairman introduced me to is so excited about this that he retired from Staples early and opened for our nonprofit, our Detroit office. Personal testimony makes a difference. And so what happened as we did taxes for low-income people? The first thing we saw was that for the medical plan, which we signed people up when they got their refunds, and remember, this was a significantly enrolled plan already. Staples has a very good medical plan. Very few people weren't in it, but we saw a 7% bump. It's very difficult to get that kind of bump in a medical plan. Even more difficult to get a 29% increase in a 401k plan. Think of how most people get induced into a 401k plan if they aren't auto-enrolled or if they didn't sign up early on. You have someone from Merrill Lynch show up and give you a boring lecture, and the needle moves 1%, 2%, hardly anything. 29% increase. And so there's power to the tax form. What's the power? I'll give you the last example first, and then I think you'll understand completely. The scholarship plan was something we introduced at Staples, and we said low-income people, they're not going to move up, mostly working in distribution centers and some in the stores. Generally, you have a little bit higher educated people in the stores, but very difficult to move up in that type of environment. You know, if you go to the grocery store and you see people who've been working many, many years, they're not getting a 3% raise. You can't go to a point where you really can raise your family in a retail environment without there being something that changes. And we were saying, you've got to get people back at least to community college. And they said, you know, people aren't going to go. And we said, yes, they will. And they said, no, they won't. And we said, well, if you can figure out a way with us to make sure they have the money to sign up to go to school, and then you reimburse them once they get a D or better, they will go, wait and see. And so we had a 42% increase in the participation in that particular scholarship plan as a result of using what we call the teachable moment. This is, in some ways, the most important thing I have to say to you, that at tax time, you have that teachable moment because people actually have money. And it's not rocket science. But people can't sign up for the 401k. They can't go to school. They're not going to get in the medical plan if they're only thinking about the fact that they're so deep in debt that they've got to figure out a way to get, you know, a payment made. And so where did we end up getting getting the payday loan industry that we have today? If you talk to people at H&R Block, they will admit in their most honest moments it grew out of the tax preparation world because they understood the teachable moment that existed to take advantage of people with loans up to 360% now. They're down in the 70 range today, but there's still a lot of exploitative work going on. And so tying this back in now to where the teachable moment was positive, we said if you can get people on the day that they know they have an average of $1,400 to put that towards something good, you've got an opportunity to actually see behavioral change in the lives of low-income, moderate means people. So that's basically the story. If you want to come back to this at all later, I'm happy to talk about this. But if you take away anything, it's that teachable moment at tax time, as people also make a decision about what they're going to do about their FAFSA, then you've got an opportunity to actually see change in the next generation as well. But what are the implications of the current tax calendar? Back to reading slides here. Because taxes can be filed as late as April 15th, the IRS is not able to provide data electronically for the FAFSA until July. Consequences are less time available to plan for college costs, and filing FAFSA after the data is available in July would frequently result in ineligibility for state and college aid. What are the implications of the FAFSA deadlines? There are concerns that if we rely on the data electronically available from the IRS, the deadline for filing a FAFSA would require using old data, and this is the AKA prior year data that many of you have heard about. Now, old tax data may not accurately reflect the applicant's current financial need. This is all from the GAO report that came out in October. There's some other concerns that were also reported by the GAO. One was that 6% of dependent applications and 13% of independent applicants came from households not required to file taxes. That's going to be an issue going forward. And then there's also the issue of what data would be used for the FAFSAs. You've got many people who still file taxes on paper. And I can promise you, from being a lot of tax sites, trying to get people to bring in old stuff when it was on paper is very difficult. It's a lot easier when people have filed electronically and you can pull it up. So locating two-year-old prior year information can be problematic. What happens next? And this is the last time that I'll be reading from slides. I just want to apologize to you again. I have learned that if I'm not specific when I'm talking about taxes or FAFSA, that I cause problems. And so I apologize, but you all saw me read every single word today, and this came directly out of the GAO reports. Students who complete the online FAFSA and enroll in college between January 1st and June 30th, 2010, have the option of transferring IRS data into the online FAFSA. If it works, and that's my words, students who apply online for aid between July and December 2010 will be able to transfer IRS data electronically. So if you were to summarize here what's happening, we've got basically a pilot project going. If that works, you know, we're going to move to another pilot project, and then there's got to be legislation passed before this can become permanent. If I had to now put on my prognosticator hat and predict what will happen, I would tell you there's just too much energy on this particular issue for us not to move further toward the tax form being used as the FAFSA. You had both presidential candidates in the last election say we're going to do this. There's a lot of energy at the Department of Education for this. You know, I have to say, I didn't notice a lot of IRS participation in this, but they seem to be willing to be drug along, if you will. So between January and June 2011, when most students are applying for fall aid for 2011, applicants who complete the online FAFSA will not have the option of electronically transferring IRS data. Why? The current law requires that the 2010 information for 2011 enrollment, which won't be available until July unless the law changes. So this is where we get to the complication. If the law doesn't get changed, then we're back to where we were. And this is why I would project that, in fact, you know, we will continue to see the legislative actions that we have seen, and there'll be more administrative work, I'm sure, as well by the Department of Education. So putting my prognosticator hat back on for another second, and maybe just making a couple of comments, we are clearly much better off where we are today having this project go on. Having the FAFSA simplified is the right thing, but there's some complexities. And I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, I've been working on this for about a year. I don't feel, as a tax person, like I've been listened to by the educational community. I don't feel that that's been true as I've tried to talk to the Department of Education. I don't feel like I've really been understood by people at schools of education. I think that the easiest way to describe this is to look here in Madison, where many of you live. 2 years ago, I was the second largest donor to and I'm going to tell you, it was a very small donation, to the free tax site out at Park Street. And so what was the amount of the second largest donor? $263. I paid for the lunch to thank hundreds of people who came in and volunteered. What was the largest donor? It was the Department of Revenue who lent somebody to that particular site. And so, you know, we've been talking about all kinds of priorities today. Fund more research. You know, I'm in favor of research. Give a bunch to Sarah. I think it would be fabulous for that to happen. But if we don't end up taking seriously the fact that these tax sites, I mean, I just want to describe some things to you. I mean, it's sad. You've got February, upper Midwest, East Coast cities, people waiting 5 to 6 hours to get their taxes done, volunteers sitting there for 8 hours, many of them over 65 years old, doing it because they've done it in the past because they know what it's like for these people. I had a woman, she hadn't taken her credits for education or for the earned income tax credit in the past. $11,000 she got back in one day, single mom. So you get the volunteers coming back because they love to get somebody $11,000. That changed that woman's life. But those volunteers working on old computers, some people still doing the work by hand, and we're talking about moving what you know is a very complex process, filling out FAFSAs. Now it's going to get shifted onto the back of volunteers who don't have the resources, you know, are trained by people like me who stop doing his own taxes, because I'm afraid that if I make a mistake on somebody else's tax form or mine, I'm going to lose the ability to continue to do this work. And I never knew very much about taxes to start with. And so we've got a train wreck coming here. I almost feel bad following Dennis, because his story was a little bit depressing at times, too. Sorry. Sorry. But, you know, you're relying upon a system, 2.8 million tax forms being done for low-income people, many of those families who have kids the ages that we care about, and we're putting the FAFSA system that probably was stressed already but relied on people with PhDs and master's degrees, and we're putting it onto a system of people who volunteer the best they can. Well, here's a statistic for you. 70% of the people who work in those VITA sites don't come back the next year. So you've got newly trained people, people like me training newly trained people to try and fix a problem that you care about a lot. So, you know, I don't want to be too negative, but if we throw all the money at research or all the money at thinking about this and don't put a lot of the resources to actually where the rubber meets the road, we're going to have a problem. And how we deal with that, I'm not exactly sure, but you guys are all smarter than I am. So I'll leave it there. I'd just say this to you. I've been told all my life by my mom that I'd be judged by the people that I spend time with, and I know a lot of you, and I know how dedicated you are to this cause, and what my mom would say is the same thing that I'll say to you. I'm proud to be associated with you, and if I'm to be judged by the work you do, I'm proud for that judgment. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dennis, and thank you, John. What we'll do is take questions until 11:50 or 11:55, Ed? 11:55? Okay, until 11:55. We'll walk around with the mic and take questions. As you can see, we purposely designed both Dennis and John to present after each other because we did want a micro to macro, macro to micro. So if some of you are thinking, well, is it a fit? Perhaps, perhaps not, but we'll see by your questions. So questions from the audience.
Hey, John and Dennis, thanks. Dennis, I heard you before at the Gear Up Conference. I heard you before, so this is good. Hey, John, could you do me a favor and go back to your last slide and explain to me why you ended it with that quote at the bottom?
This one here. You know, I felt that Dennis and I had been so depressing already, I didn't want to go here. Does anybody know what an S-corp is? So an S-corp allows you to pass through on a tax-free basis income. And we're just going to have problems. There are going to be lots of people based on the way things are drifting right now, who are very, very wealthy, who are going to be eligible for Pell Grants. And the first times that any of you are asked to defend that policy, what you're going to have to say is, it would have cost us so much to defend against that we were better off letting people cheat, effectively cheat, even though it was legal. And none of us are going to enjoy making that argument. So I'm going to apologize again for perhaps not ending on a real low note, but I felt like I'd already gone there. So,
other questions?
I'm going to pick on John again. John, a comment and a question. The comment, just for the FAFSA filers in the room, the IRS matchup that you mentioned on one of the slides that goes into effect January 2010 is only for 2009-10 years. So if you have parents in the audience who are hoping to file a FAFSA for 2010-11 next fall and spring, you will not be able to use the IRS match until July for next year because the data is not in the IRS system yet. So just wanted to, before you all start calling your various financial aid offices wondering why you can't do that match, that's why. Back to how you ended, I'm a little confused. Are you in favor or not in favor of the tax code essentially being the FAFSA? I'm not sure I understand your position right now.
I'm a team player, and every now and then I will see something rolling in a direction that is generally north. And I'm not one to quibble about whether it's going true north or magnetic north. And so I think it's really important that we be aware that there are going to be unintended consequences of this reform. And we have to be prepared for that. And so this, your question is really the same. I mean, I didn't read that last quote because I don't want to be seen as somebody who's just focusing on the unintended consequences. I'm supportive of the northern direction. And there's going to be a lot of people who said, we didn't make it to true north. And I'm going to say, you know, I kind of knew that was going to happen, but it was better that we started marching. Was that a feeble answer?
You're saying that there's some consequences unintended that will come with any system you shift. The only other thing I could think, appreciating the need for simplicity for this, then my main beef is with the tax code, which favors the wealthy enough. And so if we're really going to make gains in access, truly if we're going to go true north, we'll start overhauling the tax system because that's where the issue lies. That's where your S corporation person will not get a Pell Grant because taxed on their ability to pay, not the system that gets.
So this is the second time we all rise and say hallelujah.
It has to happen. We cannot go forward with a tax code like we have. It is just crazy to have low-income people paying 3% of their yearly income. And just wait until we start seeing the advertisements to get your tax form FAFSA completed. And there are going to be real problems. And honestly, the concept of relying upon volunteers to do this for the lowest income, that is not a viable option. Imagine me trying to get the tax forms for 90,000 Staples employees, 70,000 of them low income, done in 2,300 different storefronts as well as 70 different distribution centers. It can't be done. And so I was at the IRS yesterday saying, I've got somebody who will do $25 tax forms. Please let us use that model. I can do it in North Carolina, but there are most other states I won't be able to get somebody to help a low-income person for $25 when I couldn't find enough volunteers. Most important thing now is give a question to Dennis, because I've already talked way too much.
I have a question for Dennis. Dennis, the last issue that, or the last part of your presentation focused on the fact that we need to increase the number of individuals in the state in terms of accessing college education or higher education. But then there's also the issue of job creation, and that certainly we have an educated citizenry. We need to have employment opportunities. So my question is have we looked at, as a state, a way of quantifying our need for jobs, what kind of industries we would need in order to employ our Wisconsin residents if we're successful in moving the direction of a further educated population. You know, part of the conversation that we have with students in terms of access to higher education is, well, where am I going to be employed once I get this degree? And so it kind of loses a little steam if students are not seeing, or potential students are not seeing the value in obtaining a college degree. And another part of that is that, you know, the state of Wisconsin really is kind of losing its who it is. You know, at one time we were a manufacturing state, and then agricultural state, and I think we kind of touched on tourism, and, you know, we're kind of floundering as a state in terms of, you know, what is our identity in terms of economically speaking, and that kind of feeds into the, you know, job creation, job availability, employment, and so on. So I guess I'm really looking at the quantification. Is that a discussion that we're having at the state level? So I think that directly relates to certainly encouraging Wisconsin residents to obtain a college degree.
Well, there's a lot of items in that question, and we are, the state is, regions are, cities are, counties are, economic development groups are, all trying to figure out how they can grow their economies, as does the nation all the time. And there's, you know, out of the Harvard Cluster Project, the mapping project, Michael Porter, the kind of the latest economic development theories are what they call cluster. So in Wisconsin, we have a dairy cluster, and we have a manufacturing cluster. And by a cluster means you have essentially the raw materials, the talent, the supply chain, right, to finish it out. So we know we have people that know how to process milk into cheese, for example. We have the cows. We have the whole thing as a cluster. So that theory is kind of based on that you have some basic comparative advantage, okay? And then should you train people for the ag industry and the manufacturing industry, and then what construct are those industries going to take in the future? So we have high-tech manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We have green manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Biotechnology, you know, is coming. And, you know, 48 states we're going to put in a biotechnology center. So there's a competitive thing there. So like every day goes on, what are the best industries for a particular location, and knowing that we're going to need the talent to run more sophisticated operations because we can't compete at 98 cents an hour for unskilled labor. That's the going rate in the world. So we've got to stay on the forefront of technology. And with that then comes the training for talent. And it's kind of a long-winded answer, but it's a long, but it is a long-winded answer to the question you've had that we've been wrestling with for years and years, how to grow economy and what comes first, the talent. Now what comes first is the talent of the industry. Before, you could put a bunch of money and bring an industry in and you didn't need such skilled labor. Now you do. So that's why you have to develop both at the same time. And I'm not one, and I don't think the government should be one. I think it's the investors and the entrepreneurs are the ones that pick the winners. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, you go on to something else. And as far as training, one thing we do know is that everything that we're looking at least in America, in order to compete globally, is going to need more talent. Just to run the technology. And we're going to need technology for two reasons. One, because we're not going to have the workforce, and two, that's the only way we're going to be able to stay competitive, is minimize essentially the labor component on commodity type operations.
Do you mind if I give a short answer too? And so, as we think about where Wisconsin and the United States take our economy, we've got to look back at this particular recession and acknowledge that a big part of the problem had to do with financial services. We let this concept of, where are we going to be competitive go too far in the direction of financial services, and even things like trying to have, accountants for the world deal with the complexity we're going to produce for everybody else if they didn't do it themselves. And so when 40% of the profits in the United States economy were in financial services companies, it was clear that there were starting to be some really large problems. That wasn't a sustainable model. And so as educators, I hope that you all focus on what people can do that's practical. I'm not saying let's go out and just do manufacturing jobs or just agricultural jobs, but if we can train people to do practical things more broadly in the biological sciences, as I think Dennis implied, that would be a fabulous step forward.
But let me add one thing, too, is that if you don't get the education, your options are limited. So the more training, and I encourage, I joke with my kids, get your MD and your PhD, and then do what you want. Then you'll have something to fall back on, right? So it's the more training, you're going to have more options, and they're going to be options in what you can do, both in your job and in your location, right? But you do have to handle them both together going forward.
Doug, we have to wait for the mic, though.
Yeah, I don't know if we got anywhere near her answer, but
it's good enough.
So this question for Dennis. I'm Doug Harris. I'm also an economist, so kind of look at this the way you look at it, but then I'm also looking at it the way I think a lot of the audience is looking at it. So the topic is need-based aid, and you talked, I think your slides are really interesting in showing kind of demographically where things are going. But then the question is, policy-wise, what do we do to improve the situation? We can't control the aging of the population and so on, but we can't control policy, and the policy here is need-based aid. So I'm wondering whether you've thought about this in kind of a return on investment kind of way of thinking with your slides about what, how much investment in need-based aid would be worthwhile from the state's standpoint.
I guess I should let them have it. If you look at some of the data going back, there was this huge surge in college enrollment and graduation for the period of people born from essentially 1940 to 1950. Okay, and I put up this graph a lot of times to say, so why did this happen? And everybody's like, oh, GI Bill. And I'm like, no, because if you were born in 1940 to 1950, you weren't old enough, right, to fight in World War II or the Korean War, some of it, you know, possibly out of, after Vietnam. Sputnik, right? When the huge amount of federal money that went into education and training programs because of Sputnik, right? And if you're a Dr. Strangelove fan, you know, I mean, we had a brain power gap, right? So it all went in there. And I have a partner that I work in business, and we started out in the STEM in the STEM disciplines, and then it expanded because I have a partner that got his PhD in finance off of essentially Sputnik programs. Okay, so it has to be and where the money comes from, I got some ideas on that too. But it has to be a massive, I think, education program. Okay, and it probably only the federal government's the only one that's able to garner that kind of money and put it together. Okay, now the other one, where do you get the highest return on investment? Where do you put this money? Well, this is why I say, should I let them have it? Because one of my pet projects is early childhood development. Be for physiological reasons and economic reasons and on, the greatest return on investment you get on education is in the 0 to 5 age cohort. Okay? And there's a seminar on that I could give you and probably convince you. And the other thing is, where do we put the money in the policies? I mean, for 40, 50 years, we've been putting money into solving poverty. A work that's been done out of University of Chicago, I've changed the equation where poverty is not a education is not a function of poverty. Poverty is a function of education. And we can show that. And we got to change the policies and where the money goes. Particularly if you figure that the only way we're going to be able to stay a player in the global economy competitive-wise is to increase the amount of talent we have, the level and the amount of talent we have. Is that getting near it?
Close. I guess I'm so not going to need a corporate. Basically, if we're in a need-based aid conference, you just have to up that trade-off.
And I'm not saying all the money goes into early childhood. Okay, because if you turn out a bunch of real smart 5-year-olds and you leave them alone, right? You know, you're not going to be getting that cure for cancer. Okay. So what I'm saying is, it's got to be essentially what we call a cradle to grave, because you need it early on, and I would even submit prenatal. You need it early on, and then you need it continually. You saw a webmaster, right, 5 years ago or so, maybe more now. That was a great job, you know, computer, all that stuff. You know, that's the job of the future. You hear about that anymore? No, right? You got middle schoolers that can design your web page for you. But the people that made the tools, right, to allow that level of talent to work it, those are the folks we need. And you're not, you know, so you need the spectrum, right? And as we go forward, all the jobs that pay over $30,000 a year require some kind of post-secondary education. Now, $30,000 may be a lot of money to some kid, you know, single kid just getting out of college, but you stick on a child and a mortgage and something like that, it goes away in a hurry. So that's the other, you know, so it has to be across that whole spectrum. But one of the things you've got, the big returns on early ed, is that you've got time. You know, you're compounding the returns. So. Is that better? Sure. Well, they are. And if you add to the Brothers Grimm here, you know, in 15 years, under current conditions, in 15 years, there will be no money in the federal government to pay for anything except Social Security and Medicare. No defense, no education, no transfer programs, on and on and on.
If you want to put a dollar figure on that, some people think it's between $46 and $76 trillion just for Medicare. And the problem is, too, that it's not clear that the legislation that we're passing right now is really going to address that as directly as it could. that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000 per household of debt.
With those positive thoughts, actually, it's just before we go to lunch and before I thank Dennis and John, the context is for this forum and to take us to lunch to the next stage for our colleagues from the state of Washington, as well as the most important part, although we're all important, is the last step. Why did we want to put this information out now, early on, keep us somewhat negative or positive, is if we believe changes are required, we need to state that there's a problem. Or you could view it as a challenge. I hope it's a challenge. So, yes, some of this information this morning was on design to hit us, as we said in our staff meetings, slap us in the face, to say there are fabulous things going on in the state of Wisconsin, fabulous things. Wisconsin Covenant, the grants from the federal government, perhaps an access network, all the financial aid directors and financial aid specialists in the office who are working diligently to increase access and completion. But we also wanted to say there will have to be some policy changes given what some of the projections we heard today. So our hope is that, one, you'll stay. Two, that you will help provide ideas later on this afternoon, which our intent is that we can feed that information to WICU, Paul Nelson, for example, in the back. We can feed some of the information to Wisconsin Technical College System. We can feed information to UW System. We can feed information to HEAB, HEAB's ad hoc task force, the task force that they've created. And obviously, we can provide information to the business community and other critical stakeholders, such as we will have a new governor in November. So if you're curious, was this designed on purpose to wake us up? Yes, it was. But after lunch, we'll shift to what can we do? How can we address our challenges? So we will have lunch in the AT&T lounge right outside near the front doors on the first floor, and we'll come back at 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. So Dennis, John, thank you very much. Thank you.